Thank you for all coming. Jonathan Bayless would be very pleased to see you all in this room on his 90th birthday. And thanks to Henry and the Writers Center for hosting this. There's a program, if you don't have one, there's a few on that back table. We're going to deviate from the program just a little because Thorpe Fite is here and has to leave early, and he has a passage he would like to read. And I just want to tell you that Thorpe must have typed thousands of Jonathan Bayliss's words when they lived in the same building on Russian Net many years ago. So Thorpe knows these words better than anyone else.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much, Kathy. Okay, this is going to be... Oh, thank you, sir. This is going to be very brief, because I think there are a good many readers, and it should be brief. This is from Jonathan's book, Gloucester Book, which is not the book that I typed, by the way. I typed from an earlier work. And this is the very beginning of it. And as I say, this is very brief. Some have held this to be the best of all possible worlds, purely because it's the only possible outcome of all the causes that produced Adam and Eve. Under the circumstances, mankind can't be blamed for his own failures. Others believe that things have been needlessly unsuccessful, and perhaps that whatever we bring about will always be anything but the best possible. The most liberal view of our particular case is that we have simply made a lot of mistakes on our faultily named continent. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
So, as this is Jonathan Bayliss's 90th birthday, we struggled to figure out a theme for tonight's reading. And we've come up with 90-degree turns through Gloucester Book. So my father wrote four novels, and Gloucester Book is the first one in the Gloucester trilogy. If you ask my father what the book was about, which many people did over probably 60 years, the answer was, it's a self-describing entity. Now, if you don't find that very helpful, the fact is, it is the only description that you can say in just a few words, a self-describing entity. But luckily, we have Susan Alexi here, who's going to try to introduce us to the book in a very brief way, and she'll try to introduce the passages. But on the theme of the number 90, we're going to give you a taste of the book every 90 pages. So if you see in your program, there's a little bit from page 90, from 180, from 270. So it's very arbitrary. The only theme is that they're 90 pages apart. And they're not necessarily the easiest passage to understand, but we stuck with our theme of every 90 pages. Now, in the front matter of Gloucester Book, one will see that the book is dedicated to Lois Henderson, who was my father's mother. And I found something she wrote on September 7th of 1960, and it's a birthday poem for her oldest son. The title is At Arlington Sims Hospital, September 7th, 1926. I struggled out of dizzy mists and saw a blue September sky and gilded treetops and I prayed, thank God we didn't die. We both are here to live and love and learn and teach each other in all the beauty of the world, a boy child and his mother. So he dedicated this book to Lois Henderson Bayless. So on our program, what we're going to be doing before the readings is hear from David Rich a little bit about my father's life.
Catherine asked me to pull together about 5 minutes worth of biography on Jonathan. So I thought I would focus on those aspects of his life that maybe we don't know that well here in Gloucester, and that kind of predate Gloucester and his story. So writer of fiction, metafiction, and mytho-poetic performance pieces, Jonathan Bayless was born in 1926 in Arlington, raised in Cambridge, educated at the Newton School of South Windham, Vermont, before entering Harvard College in 1943. He left Harvard in February of his freshman year, serving as a naval electronics technician in the Pacific during the Second World War. Discharged from the Navy in 1946, he remained in the Bay Area, working as an engineering aide, a civilian radio operator, and a university lab technician, until he changed the course of his life, enrolling as an undergraduate in the English department of the University of California, Berkeley. At Berkeley, he became a serious student of the work of Irish poet William Butler Yeats, whose myth cycle plays influenced Jonathan's own theatrical adaptations of the Gilgamesh story. During those years, he operated on the periphery of the arts and literature movement known as the Berkeley Renaissance, the center of which was poet Robert Duncan. And as he once told me, he made the acquaintance of poet Jack Spicer when both were enrolled in a course of Anglo-Saxon literature. The period of life transition when Jonathan left a graduate teaching fellowship at Berkeley, taking a job as assistant manager of the Berkeley Bookstore in 1950, then as an administrative assistant at the Malmesbury Manufacturing Company in Oakland, which produced industrial steam cleaners, is the background to his 1,000-page novel, or anti-novel, Prologos. When he returned to Massachusetts, Jonathan briefly worked as an assistant to an automotive equipment manufacturer's representative in Brighton, as a sales analyst at Carter's Inc. in Cambridge, and as an analyst at the Champion Lamp Works in Lynn, which produced light bulbs. All these jobs pertained to the development of rationalized systems, information flows, and cybernetic tinkering. But it was in Gloucester Jonathan found his permanent home. He joined the Society of the Catholic Commonwealth, an obscure religious organization in East Gloucester, founded by the social justice Anglican priest Father Frederick Hastings Smythe, who appears reimagined as Father Lancelot Duncannon in the Gloucesterman series. He started work with the Gorton Corporation in 1960, rising to the position of Director of Management Services, which he left in 1972 to write full-time. And he joined a circle of local writers who regularly met with poet Charles Olson, the last rector of Black Mountain College, who had relocated to his family's vacation spot, Gloucester, in 1957 when Black Mountain closed for good and the campus sold. As Peter Anastas has told it, Jonathan, Olson, Vincent Farini, and Peter would meet at Olson's apartment at 28 Fort Square to hear Olson read from drafts of his poems, to receive news through Olson of poetry developments, and to talk into the night. Although Olson, who had developed a theory of writing based on immediacy, force, and the projected imagination or will, turned on Jonathan and his Lawrence Stern-like prose, calling him a floundering fluke, who had restored the English novel, the novel as novel. The first time, said Olson, since Henry Fielding published Tom Jones, which, as impressive as it may sound, Olson did not mean as a compliment. Jonathan continued to write, adding 400 pages to the original 600-page manuscript of Prologos he had originally shown Olson, plus three further novels or meta-novels, ostensibly written by Prologos' main character, Michael Chapman, set in a recast, renamed Cape Ann, Gloucester Book, Gloucester Tide, and Gloucester Mass. The best description of Jonathan's work is not surprisingly penned by Jonathan himself. A prose, not simply horizontal like a story, but also, or instead, vertical, skew, synchronous, cycloid, cabalistic, etiological, reversible, and exegetical. In closing, I'm happy to say Jonathan is beginning to receive some academic attention, as Harvard University's Special Collection Library, Houghton, has recently acquired approximately 30 boxes of his papers, manuscripts, and correspondence. Happy 90th birthday, Jonathan.
Thank you, David. I learned a lot just now. So now we're going to begin these readings from Gloucester Book. And Susan Alexie is going to start the readings off, and then she's going to try to explain a tiny bit before each passage and introduce each speaker.
Well, we spent some time trying to figure out what we could tell you so that the passages that you hear are comprehensible. And I won't say we gave it up, but we did give it a good try. So, first, Gloucester Book is the first of four novels by Jonathan Baylis, opens in August 1960. Rafe Opsimath, president of a West Coast manufacturer of industrial steam cleaners, travels to Darktown in Cape Gloucester. On his journey, he meets a number of residents and visitors, some of whom are clearly based on people the author knew in Gloucester. The geography is given fictional names, but most locations are easily identified, such as Cape Gloucester for Cape Ann, Saltcod Park for Stageford Park, Halibut Street for Middle Street, Finland for Massachusetts, and so forth. The geography of Cape Ann plays a prominent role. Rafe is a successful businessman who never graduated from college. He has been taking a correspondence course with his academic advisor, Doc Charlemagne, a character based on the poet Charles Olson. One of the reasons for Rafe's trip to the East Coast is to meet Doc in person. The book opens with Michael Chapman's apology to the possible reader. Michael Chapman's apology to the possible reader. As a matter of personal integrity, in resistance to the times, and in the interest of efficient information, it was impossible for me to render this transfiction in the demotic language of contemporary American literature. Possible systems of experience, like technology, can best be represented on the page, not by reducing or simplifying the complexity of English, but by fixing more dimensions of abstraction than commonly intersect as prose. Thus, the value of my construction is proportional to the number of right angles at which the unrealized concrescence makes its place. Robert Burton says, our style bewrays us. To dunces, what indeed have we to say? And yet, bar none, bid all and sundry in. Stranger, be doubly welcome, friend or foe. And that's the beginning. Now, the next page is page 90. And to set the stage, early in his Darktown visit, Rafe has a late dinner with Doc Charlemagne, who dominates the discussion. In this next passage, Doc talks about the merger of the Unitarians and Universalists and their church on Halibut Street. In real life, Charles Olson frequently had late dinners at the former restaurant next to the boulevard. And Sarah Austin will read page 90.
In his sightseeing of the USA, Rafe habitually skipped or slighted historical monuments and inscriptions, but now he remembered catching a phrase or two of the bronze plaque set into living rock at Saltcod Park to the effect that Dogtown fishermen, defending their immemorial but unrecorded industry by squatters' rights, had stood off Miles Standish, up from Best Salem, to police their commerce long before the settlement submitted even to its voluntary self-government. Quote, anyway, it was the general individualists right here in Dogtown who eventually forced genuine freedom of religion into clauses of the Vinland Constitution, finally disestablishing the separatist disestablishmentarians. That fostered the misapprehension that they were otherwise liberal and has fooled the humanist divinity parish into a poverty-driven merger, which is now about to be followed on the national level. It's to be called the Divine Individualist Church, an ill-starred marriage, here at least, greased by the accidental blandishments of language. But thank God they keep up the Bullfinch Meeting House on Halibut Street. End quote. The hearty course was served by both waitresses, who seemed trained to ask diners if everything was all right, exactly as they began to chew their first big mouthful in the midst of animated conversation, as if response was necessary at that very moment to reassure a diffident, conscientious chef. Yes, yes, said Doc, this steak is fine. Seeing that we seem to be taxing the patience of this organization by showing up at all tonight, I'd better tell you ahead of time that I'll be wanting another one. With wagging eyebrows, he challenged them impartially, the principal having willingly shared power and responsibility with her selfless auxiliary. I want you to get home early to your boyfriends. All you've got to do is repeat my order, verbatim, the whole works. Can you still read the slip you wrote before? I'll eat this one reasonably fast. Run and tell the cook right now, so he won't hang up his apron until it's quitting time. But don't bring it so soon that it'll get cold on me. And Happy New Year to him. Mr. Opsimath, will you be joining me in a second helping?
Wraith is invited to a party where he meets Dexter, Dogtown's city planner. In this next passage, Purdyville is the name given for Dogtown Common. Kilroy means automobile. And Anne Rhinelander will read a passage from page 180.
I had so looked forward to taking my own Gloucester book on a 10-day hiatus because I thought maybe I'd finally have time to read for hours and turn a page. But I can't find the book anywhere. Hopefully I get it by tomorrow morning so that I can do that. This has been fun. But Dexter's command performance was turning into a sermon. It's sheer luck if anything built on Cape Gloucester is not in bad taste. The best we can hope for is the tasteless. So one must keep up the pretense that credentials are required for any kind of aesthetic judgment, which must be delegated to referees, who of course can only be outside consultants, since nobody willing to join the city payroll could possibly be deemed qualified to make evaluations. So we're always being ground between the millstones of popular taste and blind trust in academically accredited professionals. But to my mind, it's better to risk the wisdom of fatuous arbiters than to keep asking the people what they'd like to see on the Acropolis. Whatever influence one can muster is best spent on the process of selecting specialists and on implanting in them the subliminal seeds of what you personally want. Bear in mind that if step-by-step questions were put to the voters in such a way as to elicit the real preferences of a majority, Purdyville, next to the harbor itself, our most precious public possession, would be sold off to any airport entrepreneur or Pandaland operator who promised a local payroll. For the present, there's enough solid granite under the moraine to make the blasting difficult for roads and utilities. But the time will come when nuclear bulldozers are available for anybody who can borrow money and pay real estate taxes. There was a general sigh at this pessimistic reminder, and Dexter's homily dwelt sympathetically upon the matter more troubling to marooner patriots. What's more likely in the meantime is bums and squatters. It doesn't take Irish to make a shantytown. Purdyville could become a colony of unwashed buttes. But that's the least of our worries. The horror is that it's becoming an unofficial dump. There are already junked cars and mutilated refrigerators, piles of trash and demolition rubble line the edges of any Purdyville road passable for Kilroy. If we don't do battle against the waste vandals right now, the city fathers, if they don't sell off the land entirely, will make it a dump officially. Consider the civic incentive. It would give us an irresistible advantage over other towns in attracting new industry if we could offer practically unlimited waste space as space for waste. Other towns would pay to dump their trash here. The blueberry pickers and bunny lovers would be outvoted 3-1 in any plebiscite for lower property taxes.
One of the men Rafe meets on his trip is Caleb Karsis, a young writer who, like Jonathan Bayliss, lives next to a cemetery near the railroad station. While on a walk, Caleb and his dog, Ibby, meet a young woman, Vice, who is visiting Dogtown. In this next passage, the two walk to a park high above the city. In real life, this is the little city park at the top of Commonwealth Avenue, near the train station. In the novel, Washington Street is called Cod Street. Ken Rieff will read from page 270.
Hi, folks. Caleb recalled Ibby and kept him at his side until they crossed Jubilee and started to climb the hill itself by way of Governor's Avenue, steep as any urban ascent in the old world and just as treeless, crowded with frame houses on both sides. Reminds me of Yerba Buena, said Bryce. That was the one other city they'd both been to. Since all the kids were now out of elementary school also, the neighborhood was getting loud with voices, which she smiled at when they passed, as Caleb scowled. He was taking her to survey the harbor from his favorite vantage, the climax of their loop back to Cod Street. Luckily, they found no children to disturb his pleasure in the neighbor little neglected park, a plot of jagged, striated gray rock reaching for the sky with knobby fins and arched vertebrae, scantly awash in thin swells of desiccated wintergrass. Few traces of former public investment shared the crown of Beltane Hill with a large private house situated at the peak of its naked earth bone, the spacious square cupola of which an observatory 20 feet above the harbor's highest geodetic point Caleb coveted as much as any Irish tower with a winding stair. Other neat or tattered houses, for the most part, likewise white, supported a rooftop field of old flues and new antennas that crowded the plunging trapezoid boundaries of the deserted little park below their vantage. Discreet, undisturbing shouts of distant young ones rose up from among the blended noises of the city, softened and purified by the filter of habitation. From this nexus of earth and welkin, now in taut pale sunshine, bracing their feet upon pinnacles of granite, they beheld through the disparate eyes the clear, cold city and the windless seas. From here, at least you can still see both bays, Caleb pointed out, and ocean to the east as well. And he insisted that she look behind the house at the Nemachi River Basin with wooded hills beyond the marshes, but she preferred to gaze at the outer harbor, obscured only by the clutter on its margins, spread out before them like a dreamt-up lagoon, separated with limitless waters by the long arm on the foreside, with its baton of a breakwater poised on the surface of the blue. The forlorn boats, abroad
on map of the offing seemed as motionless as differentiated dots of paint, and those underway inside the harbor moved no more perceptibly than the minute hands of an electric clock.
On a Saturday night visit to Doc Charlemagne's apartment, Caleb meets another visitor, Geppetto Vegetto, based on the poet Vincent Farini. Again, Doc does most of the talking. Diane Faisler will read from page 360.
Doc here teased Caleb with a happy grin, and analytical philosophy didn't liberate the academy. It only changed the metaphysical level of ideals. The substantive adjectives for the true, the good, and the beautiful are still construed as nouns. That much criticism was always possible, of course, but after all that's been laid open for us in these last 60 or 80 years by physics and anthropology, and now by biology, especially as the genuine ontology of the New Atlantis, it's no longer forgivable to subordinate verbs to nouns. Leaving aside questions of copulative and the existential conjugation, verbs are real, even when abstracted from particulars by a noun. The elementary fact is an act, some sort of action in detail. All pre-categorical reality is at least active, whether transitive or intransitive. The gerund and the gerundive come before the noun. In idea itself, you see, the important thing is the seeing, not the subject or the object of seeing. Neither the I nor the thou nor the idol that the alternative idealisms latch onto. If ideals are no better than matching structures, like the forms picked out by those frogs at Tech, forget the ism. The question remains what an idea is. You can't get along without ideas. Even Marx couldn't. One thing you can say is that the vision in idea is as important as it is in theater and in theory. To think, on the other hand, is the metaphor. Think of that, gentlemen. It's what makes the idioms of a language, not to mention the idiosyncrasy of a poet or the idiocy of a critic. The id and the ego, cried Petto helpfully. Let's call it the I-O.
The young man, Caleb, gets a job doing financial analysis for a priest named Chris, who is responsible for the investments supporting a tiny Anglican community in Dogtown. Parity is the name of a mysterious conglomerate that Caleb has been asked to investigate. Paul McGarry will read from page 450.
You know, when you read Jonathan, you realize every page, sometimes every sentence on every page, can be a seminar. The way his mind flits in from physics to metaphysics, from language to philosophy to ritual and theology. You really, it's, Kenny said once that you read a page, you read for a half hour and then you turn the page, and that's pretty fast, actually. Anyway, here's my page. The other day, Chris chided me with his praise. You're brainy and neurological, seldom at the mercy of your chemistry. You control your emotions electrically. That's why you can be objective about your subjectivity and how you're able to imagine things with discipline. Your mind is analytically synthetic, like Leonardo's. Caleb didn't much like the left-handed comparison with one incapable of writing a play. Yet Chris wasn't boasting about himself as one of his secular companions might have been when he said, I'm merely chemical and emotional, nothing but a creature of my bloodstream. Hormones are certainly man's humors, only I think there are combinations of more than four. And right there, you could go back to the four humors, which goes back to the Greeks, which is there's a seminar. At the moment, Chris was probably thinking of the most public of his three secret proclivities. If he's able to interest Arthur Hallam Boyd in Paraclete Biochemical Corporation, or maybe especially if he isn't, I'm afraid he'll sell all our parody and put everything directly into that hormone outfit. Of course, such a divagation of investment by parody itself would spoil my pipe dream of systemic industrial management. I almost wish I'd never called the company to his attention. Still, he's right. We may have discovered the greatest growth stock of the decade. I shouldn't let my electrical proclivity for schematic organizations stand in the way of an adventitious speculation that might vastly profit the vine in benefiting the whole world order. Of course, he's not interested in, he's talking here about birth control. Of course, he's not interested in contraception for the same reasons I am, but the way he's begun to rave about steroids, you'd never suspect he doesn't know any better than I am why they're called that. According to one of his casuistic hypotheses, the trustees' equity in Paraclete, which he describes as a high-risk property, not unlike a partnership in a Venetian argosy, would be less susceptible to the stigmatization of usury that the present diversification of its investments through parity, which regularly issues dividends. Above all, such an investment could never be reprehended as even partially militaristic or socially deleterious. On the contrary, nothing can do more than birth control to reduce poverty and stave off the apocalypse. People will never stop fucking.
And our last reading. In our last passage for this evening, the young man, Caleb, is thinking about Lillian Cloud, a former lover from the West Coast who he has discovered is now living in Dogtown with a young daughter whom he had unknowingly fathered. Doug Guidry will read from page 540.
And in all conscience, he couldn't urge upon her less than that. He wasn't brazen enough to argue forthrightly for the limited bourne of his present hope. Owing to his past responsibilities, though she never betrayed a hint of regarding it as anything but the natural termination of a nearly forgotten temporary partnership, he felt disqualified to urge upon her the favors he craved. He was now a seducer with one hand tied behind his back.
So it's 8:10, and the next events are anyone who would like to give any reminiscences about Jonathan Bayliss. There are a few people here who knew him quite well. And we also have birthday cake for you. The birthday cake is over in the corner. There's vegan chocolate cake and a carrot cake. And there's no frosting. For those of us who take the frosting off, you won't have to do that. So, is there anyone here who would like to share any reminiscence?
I'm Greg Gibson, and I'm a veteran of the Gloucester CETA program, which Jonathan was the creator, in a sense, the creator of. He was certainly the founding spirit of it, and he chose the people who participated in it. And the remarkable thing to me, I just thought about this when Kathy talked about this event. Celia, Irma Wheeler,
Norma Cuneo,
Henry Farini, Norma Cuneo,
Martin Ray,
Tim Harney, Ellen Farron, and all these people that he chose for this like poverty program, turned out to be substantial contributors to the artistic life of Gloucester and Cape Ann. And this was Jonathan's idea, his concept. And it was, to me, typical of his mastery of this kind of systems stuff, that he really made it work. He gave these people an opportunity, they flourished, and they went on to contribute to their community. So, just another side of Jonathan that
Anyone else? We're tossing around this acronym CETA, C-E-T-A. What did it stand for?
Comprehensive Employment and Training Act.
Comprehensive Employment and Training Act.
I had one of those jobs, too.
And I guess my father was either, he must have been administrative assistant to the mayor at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyone else? Yes.
He said it was cetaceous because it was a huge whale.
On Whale Avenue. Anyone else? Garrett, would you consider saying anything?
Without getting up? I won't get up, but certainly Jonathan was one of the first Gloucester citizens, the three that I knew well when I first, in 1959, came to Gloucester. And it was at Jonathan's house on Washington Street that I first was given steamers, which I'd never eaten before, from Ohio, which I really loved. And much later, Jonathan and I took walks together, talked about liturgy and various things, ritual and its relation to myth. And he was a very warm person. Thank you.
Thank you, Garrett. Anyone else?
I have a question, I guess. Along the lines of being a great administrator who can make their pet projects happen, do you know the specifics about his use at Gorton's of their really early computer program, like the punch card driven program, to create something that could organize dramatic play scripts that he used for the Gilgamesh plays? Are you very familiar with this?
You've said almost everything I know, but in those days, this was long before personal computers, and most businesses, if they had a computer at all, it was huge banks, huge mainframes, and Gorton's was a leader in the early 60s in the use of its IBM, I think, 360 computer. And my father did a lot of things for Gorton's using the computer system and had some ideas that later became published in, like, the Association of American Management, publications like that. But one thing he did, which I assume he did with permission, because I wouldn't like to think that he was abusing Gorton's resources, he was writing his plays at that time, and he devised a way to put the text on punch cards, because there was no keyboarding at that time other than onto punch cards. And what would come out is a computer printout with all those holes on the edges of his play. And he could produce multiple copies of it, and he could fairly easily change the text. That's about all I know. I think the Houghton Library now does have some of the of these faded computer printouts.
I once described to Jonathan what it was like in the spreadsheet, and he got this wistful look on his face, and he said, "Yeah, I had that idea." He said, "I never really pursued it, though." It was a kind of a certain amount of disappointment that he hadn't pursued.
Any other comments? Yes, Ken.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just remembering, I'm hoping Henry can remember this, when we were shooting people in a nice way for the Olsen film. We did go over to visit him, and I'm trying to remember, he never did appear on the film, and he was reluctant, and I think it was because he said his memory was failing. I mean, do you remember exactly what it was that prevented him from wanting to go on camera?
I think it was stuff that he was working on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he did mention, I do remember that he said he, it was a long time ago, but he was still in pretty good shape.
You mean psychologically or literally? Literarily.
Literarily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he had his disagreements with Olson.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
I thought maybe you might remember it better than I do, but I had the sense that he wasn't real confident in his recollections of certain things, even though you know he had a vast
because we didn't. We just talked. We didn't tape.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's unfortunately that's not in the archive.
Yeah.
Can you just give us a couple of words about what he was like as a father? Know much more about how he was as a writer and a manager and all kinds of things, but how was he as a father?
You know, it's hard to say in a nutshell what someone was like when you knew them so well, but he had a very, very difficult childhood. His mother was left as a divorced woman with three children under the age of five. He was the oldest, he was five. And his father started a new family and did not pay a whole lot of attention to his former wife's children. And I believe that that had a major role in how he felt he had to behave with his children. And my sister and brother are here, I'm sure, they wouldn't disagree. He was very, very supportive, conscientious. For a man that really wanted to spend his time writing, he had to earn a living to support the whole family, and he did that conscientiously until he was able to retire and write full time. But he was very conscientious, very careful about our development, read to us a lot, especially out of The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling. Do you want to add something?
I think one thing is that although he would spend a lot of his weekend up in the attic writing, and so we didn't see as much of him as maybe in other families they would see of their father, he did say towards the end of life, you know, this is your legacy, meaning these books, you know, here it is, especially Prologos, you know, so it's kind of like everything you wanted to know or missed out on or something, it's all in here. So I think there was a certain, you know, certain...
Yes, Danusha.
I'd like to say a few words about Jonathan as a potential friend. It was the year 2000 or 2001 or two when I had published my translation of Witold Gombrowicz's groundbreaking book that he wrote in 1937. He was an avant-garde writer before the existentialists. So anyway, I was reading from this book at the bookstore and Jonathan was in the audience. Well, afterwards he approached me, and we had, you know, a few very pleasant encounters. I was going through some painful time with my husband at the time, and I said, well, I'm feeling kind of lonely and sad. So he said, well, please come and visit, come to the house. Well, I thought I was a little bit too courageous or something. An intruder, an outsider, so I never followed him. But he was most kind. And I appreciated the fact that he came to the reading of this amazing author that not many people know.
Well, should we have cake? There's wine and cake, and we'll start cutting pieces of cake. Thank you all for coming. And,